WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
John McPhee is one of America's most respected and envied writers, respected for stretching the artistic dimension of reporting, as William Howarth once put it, envied because his status as a New Yorker staff writer has allowed him to spend months or years on a story and to take as many pages as he needs to tell it. As for subject, McPhee writes about people, places, and phenomena that interest him. He's written profiles of tennis star Arthur Ashe, basketball player and senator Bill Bradley, curator Tom Hoving, and physicist Ted Taylor. His interest in geology and the outdoors has led to pieces on Alaska and the Pine Barrens. His essay Oranges told the botanical processing and marketing history of the ever-popular citrus fruit. McPhee lives in Princeton, where he grew up. He's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1965. Most of his New Yorker pieces are later published in book form. His latest book, The Control of Nature, features three reports about attempts to control threatening natural forces, a river, a volcano, and landslides. I asked McPhee what led him to this subject.
I have a daughter named Sarah who was in college in the 6 or 7 years ago and was taking a course from Robert Coles on the work of Walker Percy. And she was totally swept away by Walker Percy and wanted to go to Walker Percy country for a spring vacation. And I said, fine, we'll go down there, but what's in it for Dad? And after some research, what was in it for Dad was a canoe trip in the a brief one in the Atchafalaya Swamp with an LSU professor and another friend of ours. And the four of us went out into the swamp. And while I was there, I learned that all of the water in the swamp was controlled by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at a place called Old River, where they were valving the Mississippi and preventing it from going off in a direction in which the Mississippi wants to go, but in which the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wanted it not to go. And I thought that was a wonderfully symbolic situation of the flat-out struggle between human beings and nature, because the Mississippi has greatly shifted its course down there about once every 1,000 years. And the time had come in the 1950s and thereabout for this to happen. And so they're down there trying to prevent it. And when I got the idea of doing a piece on that and all its implications and ramifications, I thought of doing more pieces in the same theme. And a man at the Waterways Experiment Station in Vicksburg said, well, if you're interested in this theme, you ought to go to Los Angeles and look into the debris basins. And I said, you know, the debris basins? And he said, yeah, they're catching the falling rocks of the San Gabriel Mountains to keep them off Johnny Carson and so on.
One of your three pieces is called Los Angeles Against the Mountains, and it's about the debris flow. There's a paragraph in that I'd like you to read that kind of describes the magnitude of the debris.
In geology, it would be known as a debris flow. Debris flows amass in stream valleys and more or less resemble fresh concrete. They consist of water mixed with a good deal of solid material, most of which is above sand size. Some of it is Chevrolet size. Boulders bigger than cars ride long distances in debris flows. Boulders grouped like fish eggs pour downhill in debris flows. The dark material coming toward the genophiles was not only full of boulders, it was so full of automobiles it was like bread dough mixed with raisins. On its way down Pine Cone Road, it plucked up cars from driveways and the street. When it crashed into the genophiles' house, the shattering of safety glass made terrific explosive sounds. A door burst open. Mud and boulders poured into the hall. We're going to go, Jackie thought. Oh, my God, what a hell of a way for the four of us to die together.
It's really wonderful descriptive writing in that paragraph. I really like the Chevrolet-sized boulders. I think it was just the right word to use. How do you choose your subjects? Actually, what I'm wondering is if you've ever bailed out of a subject, if you've ever started to write about a person or a phenomenon or a place and decided that you made the wrong choice and you weren't going to go through with it.
Early in the process, early in the cycle, I mean, you get an idea and then something begins that might fetch up a year or two, certainly months, but maybe a year or two or three later with a finished piece of work. And very early, something might not work out. Or after some travel, but I've never begun. If I begin writing something, I think it's going to be okay, or I wouldn't be beginning it. And then there's so much just difficulty along the way, and I lose confidence so much that if I were to quit at that point, I wouldn't know whether it was because it wasn't working out or because I was chickening out. So I always finish.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer John McPhee. I've always thought of your style in part as finding the macrocosm and the microcosm, looking at something very specific and looking at it so carefully that suddenly things much larger, ideas much larger begin to emerge. And this one person or one phenomenon that you're looking at becomes almost a metaphor for things larger than itself. Does that jive at all with the way you see your kind of writing?
Well, I sort of hope that happens. I'm glad to hear you say that. but I don't, I think it would be dangerous to sit down and say, enforce something like that. You know, you just by attending to the story you're trying to tell, you may hit such a level. But I don't consciously try to do that.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest amount of time you've ever spent on one story?
3 years.
And which one was that?
Coming into the Country.
What was it, about Alaska?
About Alaska.
And you lived there for the full 3 years, or
no,
you went back and forth?
No, I went up there about 4 times for visits ranging from 6 weeks to 4 months. And in the rest of the time, I was at home in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, working on that piece at home. There was a great deal of reading involved, and of course, the writing always takes longer. I was figuring the other day, it takes about 7 days in Princeton for every one that I'm out somewhere, generally.
You mean 7 days of writing?
Yeah, I mean, people will ask me, does your family miss you? And I say, they're only too happy to get rid of me because I'm back there writing, 7 or 8 days for every one that I'm traveling. And furthermore, the writing goes on. I mean, it might last 15 months, the 15 months of writing. And if you've ever lived with somebody who's doing 15 months of writing, you'd be glad to get rid of them too. And so then the time comes up and I go off for a couple of weeks and then come back again. That's how it works. It's most of the effort is locked away in a room by yourself.
Do you feel really differently about the part of your work which takes you out into the world, out to, say, Alaska, and the part of your work which keeps you in your room with the typewriter locked up writing?
I certainly do. And there's a cycle that I mentioned earlier, and the part that when I'm out in Alaska is really quite splendid, and I'm very lucky to be there and to be able to do that. And the part when I'm doing the writing is a process in which I begin with zero confidence every time and gradually build up a little bit over a very long period of time as this the writing itself slowly accumulates.
What's responsible for the zero confidence when you know your track record?
I don't know. But I can tell you that I'm telling you the truth.
Yeah, no, I don't.
But I don't know.
Doubt that.
I mean, I don't know why. I don't. if it's the first draft, maybe this. When you are putting together a piece of writing in its initial phase, you have nothing and you are trying to suspend your life so you can recreate something that went on in life a little before. And you do not write well right away. And if you're going to get anything done at all, you have to blurt out something, and it's going to be bad. And to sit there and do something that's bad all day long is unpleasant. But when you've done this enough, you have the so-called rough draft. And at that point, when I do have a draft, something's on paper, and it's really miserable, I change a little. When I'm confronting material that exists, the writing that actually exists, I can work on it and make it better. And I relax a little, and I get a little more confident when I'm in that second, third phase, or whatever, how many times it takes.
You're notoriously obsessive about your writing. Can you describe how you organize the notes that you've taken back with you from the place that you've been writing about?
Well, I copy them all first on a typewriter, it used to be, and now it's in a hard disk. And then when all the notes are assembled in this one document, I study that and look for a structure for the piece of writing that will rise out of those notes, rise organically out of the material that I have there, and not be imposed from the outside. I mean, a prefabricated structure is not what I would want to find, but an organization, a sequence for the material that I would be dealing with, and that makes sense and that yields the best result through juxtapositions of things and whatever can legitimately be done within the context of a factual piece of writing. And that excites me quite a bit, and it might last for several weeks with a long piece as I try to figure all this out and then arrange it so that when I begin a piece of writing, I always know where it's going to end and where it's going to go. The notable exception to this is that I haven't mentioned is that I always write a beginning, a lead, first, because that really primes the pump. If you have a successful lead and you know that it works and it makes sense in terms of the piece, that it doesn't promise too much, and that it arrests attention in a fair way, then I stop and go back and do all that organizing I'm talking about.
Can I read you the lead from the first essay in The Control of Nature?
Please.
And I'd like to know how you hit on this and knew that this would be the way to start. 300 miles up the Mississippi River from its mouth, many parishes above New Orleans and well north of Baton Rouge, a navigation lock in the Mississippi's right bank allows ships to drop out of the river. In evident defiance of nature, they descend as much as 33 feet, then go off to the west or south.
So why did I use that lead?
Yeah.
Well, you see, the ships are dropping out of the river and going off to the west or south. If that's happening, the river must want to go there too. So we have the very basic situation, but it's presented in terms of the ships and in a way that I hope will
exemplify.
Yeah, exemplify it and make somebody want to find out, hey, why is this? Why would a big boat go out of the Mississippi River 300 miles from its mouth and go downhill on water? There's something odd about that. And of course, the something odd about that is what the whole piece is about. And I like to say that a lead ought to shine like a flashlight down into the whole piece, if possible. And I hope that one does.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking about organizing the notes that you bring home. Physically, how do you organize it? Physically, how do you organize all the information you have before you've actually written it up?
Say I've decided that there are 16 parts of this story. This is just by making little notes as I go along and then looking at those notes, boiling them down, and then I end up with with the idea that my body of notes, 55,000 words of notes or whatever it is, this body of notes is going to work out in 16 parts, but I don't know what's first, second, third, or fourth. And then I might put a little something on a 3x5 card that identifies each of those 16 parts. And then I will look at those cards for a long while to see relationships. What might go next to what? Some things have to be where they are because that's when it happened, but you can use flashbacks, flash forwards. There's all sorts of ways, quite legitimately, to arrange a piece of writing. And what you're looking for is to have this material yield the best dividends through structure. And then I go through the whole body of notes and look at each note, and I'll go down from one note to another and assign it to one or another of those 16 places. And I used to then tear up the notes with a pair of scissors or something, but I have a friend at Princeton named Howard Strauss who has written stuff for my computer which causes it to, it'll dive into those notes, it'll take the whole 55,000 words, it'll throw them up in the air, it'll fluff them up to about 75,000 words, and it'll cause them all to settle down into 16 files with 16 names attached to them that are all in the hard disk and the original preserved too, and all this occurs in 4 minutes while I sit there watching a red light.
Right.
But it's the same thing I used to do with Xerox and stuff like that. It sounds very mechanical, all this, but the purpose is to separate the material, to put it away so that when I'm doing a given section, one of those 16 things, I know what's in it, I can read over those notes, and thus I'm liberated to write. I have no excuses. That's the purpose. The purpose is to, of all that, is to get me out into no man's land where it's just myself and this machine now, the computer that I stare at all day.
My guest is writer John McPhee. You had told an interviewer for the New York Times that back when you were getting started writing after college, when you were writing for a TV drama series, Robert Montgomery Presents, that you used to every morning put on your bathrobe and, you know, put the tie around it and then use that tie to tie yourself to the chair so that you'd stay put by the typewriter and write.
The sash or cord that, you know, whatever it is in a bathrobe that goes around your waist.
Yeah.
And the chair was a so-called captain's chair with the vertical spindles, you know, around the back. So I threaded it in and out of that and then around me. And one time the doorbell rang. I was in an apartment in New York and I stood up to go answer the door and the chair got up with me.
Well, did that help, actually tying yourself to the chair?
No, it's just an illustration of how miserable writing can be. And, and I mean, I'm not a sedentary person. I don't belong in a chair.
Uh-huh. So what do you do now to keep yourself in the chair?
Well, I'm older and I can sit still a little better. That was, you know, I was 23 years old or something like that, 24 when that happened. And I've been at it so long, I actually sort of relish the time alone. I have no difficulty sitting in that room for all those hours by myself because I guess I just learned to do that through time.
Mm-hmm. Although you spend much of your life talking to people for pieces that you'll be writing, you actually do very few interviews yourself. I mean, you allow yourself to be interviewed very seldom. And I was wondering why.
Well, I don't know. It's complicated. First of all, I'm always behind in my work. But for another thing, it's my work that I hope that will be known, not so much myself. I mean, I enjoy doing this once in a while, but I prefer just to publish the material and go home.
Mm-hmm. This explains too why there's
not a very good answer.
Well, this explains too why there's so few pictures of you.
Yeah, well, I think that I don't think a writer should intrude between a piece of writing and a reader.
But you use the first person in your pieces.
Where I have to. If I have to. I mean, there are situations, if you're on a canoe trip with a group of people and you're one of the people, it would be ridiculous not to. And if there's other situations, I did a thing once about an experimental aircraft. It was called the Deltoid Pumpkin Seed. And it was 60,000 words long, and there was one place in this whole story where I needed to appear as I. And that is that near the end, when this thing finally got itself going and was up off the ground, another person in the group got into a Cessna to fly up and fly with it. And I went with him. And at that point, I had to say, I got in the Cessna. Otherwise, how did this author suddenly appear 1,000 feet in the air? And so I took that into the New Yorker, and my editor there, Bob Bingham, said, that just can't be. That it sticks out like a sore thumb, this eye way over near the far end of the story. And he said, can't you find a place at least to do it one other time? And so I hunted around in the front of the piece and found a scene that happened in a Exxon station somewhere, and I put the eye in there, and I still regret it. but only because it didn't belong. I mean, I'm not shy to say I if there's no alternative.
Well, John McPhee, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about writing. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.